It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret.
This morning, the United States issued a global travel alert because of an Al-Qaeda terrorist threat, with the potential for terrorism particularly strong in the Middle East and North Africa.
The threat has also prompted the State Department to direct its embassies to close on Sunday in key Middle Eastern nations, including Egypt and Israel.
Joining us to talk about the alert and its significance is Tom Makaitis, terrorism expert and professor of history at DePaul University. Professor Makaitis, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Well, it seems like it's been a while since we've seen one of these terror alerts issued. Do you have a sense of how long it's been?
Well, they're issued periodically. If you go on the website, you know, of the State Department, there are all kinds of warnings and alerts to Americans traveling abroad and so on. This is a bit more general. And I think part of the reason is after the flurry of alerts after 9/11, we've gotten much more discerning and much more focused in these kinds of warnings, because otherwise they don't have much meaning and aren't much help.
Now, let's just be clear about where this alert is directed. Is this for domestic travel here in the United States, or it sounds like it's primarily abroad?
It's, as far as we can tell, exclusively abroad, and not only abroad, but specific to a distinct region of the world, which is the Middle East and North Africa. They have, you know, what we talk about is background information called chatter, which indicates, you know, just sort of something in the wind. This seems to be a lot more specific. There are references to a threat coming out of Yemen, where Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is located, most of its training camps and compounds. And the areas that are affected are the North African embassies and those in the Middle East and some in the Gulf.
Now, so the State Department has been picking up increased chatter, and I'm assuming that they must have deemed it significant enough that they had to use one of these alerts, which hasn't been used in a while. Can you give us a sense of how significant you think this is right now?
Well, it's more than chatter. Chatter is a term that refers to just general heightened activity that says, you know, there's more intelligence intercepts, more going on, but we can't exactly say where. This looks to be a very specific kind of warning at a focused area of the world. And, you know, we have a system of alert within the United States. We went from the colored-coded to imminent and an elevated threat. Overseas is a little different. These are specific instructions to the embassies to close on a particularly significant day in the holy month of Ramadan, and with the opportunity, with the possibility of extending that. And they're region-wide, so this can mean one of two things, that they know of a threat to multiple embassies, or that they have indications of a probable threat, but they're not sure which one, so they're simply being safe.
So how significant do you think this is right now, given what we've heard?
I think it's very significant, because it's so specific. You know, when the warning is very general, this used to happen after 9/11. They'd say, you know, we're going up to orange alert over the summer. And I'd invariably get called into the TV station and say, Professor, what should we do? I say, well, put on your seatbelt and wear sunscreen. The point being is that the warnings were so broad, so vague, that either they just upset everybody, or after a while they became like the boy who cried wolf. That, you know, you only warn people when they can actually do something specific. In this case, you can. Now, the truth be told, I don't think anybody in their right mind is traveling to Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and certainly not Yemen. By the same token, to go to the level of closing down an embassy, you know, that is in itself an interesting thing. Now, you know, closing also is an interesting question. I suspect in Yemen you have many of these embassies are fairly large compounds with living quarters in them and so on. So I think, you know, saying that they're closed doesn't mean nobody will be in them. What it means is they will not be open for business for anybody wishing to enter and use their facilities on the day in question.
Gotcha. So those color-coded alerts that we used to have, the orange alerts and all that, and you never remembered what this color signified, how alarmed you should be at the moment. So those were not deemed, you know, very helpful.
No, they were exactly right. No, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, that's exactly right. We had a five-coded color system. You may recall that for much of the year after 9/11, we were either yellow or orange alert. And the problem was that, you know, as I said, there was the numbing effect or there was the paranoia effect. The other concern was is that, you know, there was a suspicion that every time there was a desire to, you know, push a security-related measure or legislation or activity abroad, that we seemed to go up to orange alert. So people got away from that, and they began to get more specific. And that's a healthier way to go. You know, for example, in 2006, with the warnings over the peroxide bombs, you know, going out of Heathrow Airport in London, this is the reason we no longer can carry liquids on the planes. They were very, very specific. You know, everybody is not allowed to do this, but we're only going to go to orange alert on the routes going into England. Okay, so they got specific there. And that's been the pattern ever since. So, you know, there have been warnings and so on. In some cases, you know, you just have quiet warnings to local law enforcement or to individuals or to the embassy itself, et cetera. And the thing, too, is, you know, I just got back from Colombia, and before we could even leave the hotel by myself, we had to have a security briefing. These are the areas you don't, as in Bogota, these are the areas you don't go. These are the areas you go with somebody. These are the areas you don't go at night, but you can go during the day. So, you know, there are all kinds of travel advisories, all kinds of alerts, all kinds of precautions on the State Department website as on a routine, regular basis that every American traveling overseas should take a look at. But this is much more than that. This is apparently some very, very specific intelligence, or at least specific enough to do a region-wide action of this type.
So if State Department officials know that something is happening and they've got enough evidence on hand to issue the alert, why don't they just say what it is so that it takes the veil of mystery? Because when we don't know something, we're more afraid.
Well, first of all, there's knowing and knowing. I mean, they probably have what's called strategic warning. In other words, they have a general indication of the area and the possibility of an attack. That's very different from knowing about, you know, tactical warning. You know, say, I know specifically that something is going to happen on this day. Let me give you a specific example for you. I mean, I went to the University of Wisconsin in graduate school. You know, if Wisconsin beats Ohio State in a football game, it's a pretty good indication that State Street will be lively that night. So the police can say, hey, guess what? We're going to put extra people on the street. That's very different than saying, you know, the nitty-gritty or the Broughton Brow, or I'm assuming the restaurants are still there, I don't know, you know, is going to be targeted by hooligans at a particular moment
right.
in time. So, you know, that's a microcosm idea here. Well, in fact, you know, they probably don't have that specific information. And the other issue is how much do you say? You want to warn enough, but you don't want to give away your sources. There's also politics in this, too. You know, I mean, after this is the anniversary of the Benghazi attacks, which were damaging to the president and the White House. So you don't want to be caught in a situation where they'll say, well, geez, you had information and you didn't tell us. You know, I mean, it's also keep in mind, you know, if the airlines, you know, shut down with every threat, we would probably never fly. There's always an effort, you know, a bit of discernment and assessment that has to go on as to how credible things are. But this one seems to be pretty credible.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on that this weekend. Professor Mikaitis, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me. Happy to talk to you.
That was Tom Mikaitis, professor of history at DePaul University, where he teaches military history. His research and writing cover terrorism, insurgency, and peace operations.
Coming up, we'll talk with Grammy Award-winning musician Steve Earle. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Grammy Award-winning artist Steve Earle right there. He's in Wisconsin for a few days. He's going to be playing in Door County tonight. He's got Madison on the docket tomorrow. And he's wrapping things up at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee on Monday, August 5th. So a lot of chances there to hear Steve Earle in Wisconsin. And we'll be talking with him in a little bit.
He's actually covering a lot of ground in Wisconsin alone with all those dates. But he's also covered a whole lot of ground in his career. That piece of music we just heard a little bit of was Copperhead Road, one of his probably one of his bigger hits in terms of radio. He's also a writer. He's an actor. You may have seen him in Tremé. You've probably seen him in The Wire. And you've certainly heard his music all over the place. And he has a new album out called The Low Highway. We're going to be talking to Steve Earle in just a minute. Also, a little later on the show, we're going to be talking about something a little different, roller derby.
Roller derby, right. So the biggest roller derby gathering in the country is actually happening right now in Las Vegas. And one of our producers, she's not here right now, but Amanda Magnus, is really into roller derby. And she produced that segment for us. And we're going to try to get a handle on exactly what roller derby is. That's coming up.
Yeah, that's ahead in just a little bit. But right now, I think it might be a good idea for us to talk to Steve Earle, don't you think, Veronica?
I think it sounds like a good idea, in fact, since we've got him on the line. Steve Earle, welcome to Central Time. Steve, are you with us?
Steve Earle.
All right. We are still going to try to reconnect. We've got some phone issues going on right now. But you know what? I'm confident we're going to get him back on the line. So why don't you give a call if you'd like to talk to Steve Earle? We can have some phone calls line up and tell us about your experience with him over the years. He's had a long, storied career. Mike was just telling you about some of it, and he's been politically active. He's been involved in a whole lot of things. He's been a writer. He's been an actor. And, of course, he's been a musician, and a very active musician at that, who's shared the personal. He's also talked politics as well. And you can get your phone call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. When we get him back on the line, you can talk about what his music has meant to you.
And to sort of set things up a little bit, let's listen to a little bit of Steve Earle's latest music. This is The Low Highway from his new album, CD, whatever the heck you call it these days, The Low Highway, here on Wisconsin Public Radio Central Time.
Traveling now on the low highway, 3,000 miles to the Frisco Bay, across the rivers wild and along some plains, up a coast and down, back again. I saw empty houses on dead end streets. People lining
and that is a cut from Steve Earle's new album, The Low Highway. And we know that somewhere out there in the world, Steve Earle is trying to call us.
He may even be listening to the radio right now.
Listening to his own music.
And we will be talking to him about his music and hopefully give you a chance to talk to him as well in just a little bit here on Central Time. So we hope that you'll do that. Steve Earle, again, in Wisconsin, playing a number of shows. He's going to be in Door County tonight. He's going to be in Madison tomorrow. He's going to be in the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee on Monday. We're looking forward to having a conversation with him. He's a guy who gets a lot of attention from people. So one of the reasons why it's been difficult for us to connect with him is that he calls us. We don't call him. So we don't know his number or anything like that. It's kind of a nice way to work on things sometimes. So that's what we're doing. And why don't we listen to a little bit more of another Steve Earle song? This is Invisible. Thunder rolls, and I'm okay.
listening to a song there from Steve Earle called Invisible. And Steve Earle, are you with us?
I hope so.
Excellent.
We hope so, too.
It's so great to hear your voice.
I don't know. I was like, I was starting to think that I've been for a bicycle ride in the park here, and I just kind of, we're at Fish Creek and, tonight, so I was... I thought maybe it was me, that maybe it was just my electrolytes are low.
Our electrolytes were getting a little low, actually, as we kept trying to wait for you to call.
Yeah. Well, I called. I kept calling, trust me. And we had you 1 minute. And as soon as we would transfer it over, it's an ISDN thing. Who knows?
Like,
I have a radio show, too. I go through that from time to time.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we got you on the line now. I think a voice has never sounded so sweet. So, Steve, tell us what you're doing here in Wisconsin the next few days.
God, paying the bills mainly. John Hyatt and I are doing the second of two shows together, which we do from time to time. We were at the zoo in Minneapolis last night, which I'm not so sure what the Tigers thought about that, but it was like that's where we were. And it's a regular gig. I've played it several times. And then tonight in Fish Creek and at the community auditorium here at Door Community Auditorium. And then we'll be playing, a couple of shows on our own, which are regular stops for us, which will be us and the Mastersons. They're actually my guitar player and fiddle player, Chris Masterson and Eleanor Whitmore, who have a great record out. And they open the shows, and they are, kind of what bumped this whole band up to a whole other level, which actually sort of was the beginning of the whole impetus for recording this new record, was just the band. Just having the best band I've ever had.
Yeah, the band is getting rave reviews, as is this album. Can you tell us a little bit about, now, while we were waiting to connect with you, we played some of your music for folks, starting off with The Low Highway. So tell us a little bit about this new album and how it came to be.
Well, like I said, I had the best band I'd ever had, and it deserved to be recorded. I'd made a couple of records in a row that were departures from recording with my own band, which I did for years. And, so I didn't record with the band. I didn't tour with the band. But I did the Town's record was all solo, and Washington Square Serenade was sort of arrived at by me sitting around playing acoustic instruments with beats. And so I toured with a DJ on that record. And so I made a record with T-Bone Burnett called "I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive," and I recorded that with his players that he normally works with, because that's the way working with T-Bone works. But then to play those songs, I needed my band plus. Kind of in a bag of chips. I had to sort of bring with a four-piece band for a long time. So Chris Masterson had been kind of in line for the guitar gig for a long time, and his wife, Eleanor Whitmore, is a great fiddle player. And so they came along, and then Allison was originally touring with us and is on this record as the keyboard player. She's playing piano and organ and accordion and all. So she's not touring with us now, though, isn't it? John Henry's in school, so she's having to sit this one out.
Nice.
Could you talk a little bit about songwriting? Because it seems like sometimes you write songs that are really personal, and then other times you write songs that are about other people. How does that work for you?
Well, I think they're all personal. I mean, John Walker's Blues, is about... a kid from California who traveled away to learn Arabic and the Quran and ended up in the middle of a war and on what everybody perceived to be the wrong side. And but I wrote it because I have a son exactly the same age as John Walker Lind. And so it's all pretty personal. Pete Seeger said that all music is political because, lullabies are political to babies. And it's not, it's true. I mean, you can look at it both ways. I think it's all personal and it's all political when it gets right down to it.
Well, we've been hearing about the ground you've been covering just in Wisconsin. I mean, you've been on the road for decades now. You're a legitimate road warrior. What does it feel like to have seen that much of America over the years? How does it make you feel?
Well, that's a lot of what this record was about. I've seen it, and I'm on intimate terms with it, if you will, and it dawned on me when I was making this record that what I was seeing was for the first time was an America much closer to what Woody Guthrie saw. I mean, I'm seeing it from a $750,000 bus rather than a boxcar. But it's true that all of us do this job following Bob Dylan's footsteps, and Bob invented it while he was sort of creating himself in Woody Guthrie's image. But he was something that Woody wasn't. He was like the melodies began to be his own after a while, and he really was a genius, but all of us that have done the job in Bob's footsteps, what we have in common, including Bob, is none of us saw times like Woody was singing about. This music and a lot of rock and roll, and a lot of, you know, which is rock and roll, folk music, country music, it's all really the same thing, and it all has roots in the Depression. It all has roots in hard times. And most of all the time I've been playing it, have been pretty good times overall for the world, and especially for this country. And it's not true anymore. Right now, things are tough out there for everybody. So we're seeing closer to what Woody saw, and it just sort of dawned on me. And that's a lot of what the record's about. Plus, I was in a TV show called Terme, and that's about post-Katrina New Orleans, and that's part, that story's about these economic times as well. The reason New Orleans is still in trouble is funding. You can't take over the world and lower taxes at the same time. It's simply not fiscally.
We're going to continue this conversation with Steve Earle in just a minute. We're talking to Grammy Award winning musician Steve Earle. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're going to be taking a quick news break, and then we'll be back to talk more with Steve Earle. I'm Mike Arnold.
I'm Veronica Rickard, and this is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Steve Earle. He's playing tonight in Door County and at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee on Monday night, August 5th. This is a tune he wrote for The Wire. Some of you would live through me and lock
me up and throw away the key. So, Steve Earle, hope you're still on the line there. All right. Before the news break, we were talking about how you said that you feel like you're sort of living in Woody Guthrie's times right now. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's just things are tough out there. They're genuinely tough. I mean, it's not just here. It's all over the world. Starting to feel it in Canada. They're not feeling it as intensely in Europe and in Canada because they tend to be they have systems that tend to take care better care of people in hard times than we do. Most people have health care and you know, these things that we keep talking about. And
So basically, as you see this, as you go around the country and around the world with different people, is you write about it, I guess.
Yeah, it's my job. It's just what I do. I probably, when I die, they'll figure out I wrote more songs about girls than I did anything else. But it's not, that's kind of political, too, when it gets right down to it. So it's not, you just write about, this job is, making any kind of art is you have to be kind of unafraid of letting people know something about you, and what you arrive at is this sort of you're talking about yourself, the stuff that you know the most about, your own fears and your own aspirations, but it's about what you have in common with your audience, not the difference between you and your audience.
So you're thinking about, you're sort of imagining your audience as you write things then?
Well, no, I think it's what's important is just to forget that, not to forget that, everybody, the blues are universal, being happy is universal, being in love is universal. And I think righteous indignation is universal. And so these are things that you can get an audience to agree with you about or disagree with you about, which is okay, too.
You seem like you're pretty comfortable in your own skin. You share a lot of personal stuff in your songs, like Mike was just talking about and you were just talking about. You've also played an addict on The Wire, and people who know your background know this is something you struggled with.
There was no acting required. That's why I got that
job. That was just you on The Wire.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, that's why the job was given. It was the first acting I ever did. I'm more acting in Treme than I was on The Wire, and it's one of those things that I don't know how comfortable in my own skin I am. I just have tools to deal with the days that I'm uncomfortable in it better than I used to. It's really the only way to explain it. I'm gonna have to, I'm not even close to enlightenment. I just basically wake up in the morning and do the same things I know I need to do to keep from ending up back where I started again. This is still very much about, I still go to meetings, call my sponsor and sponsor people. I'll have 19 years in September, knock on wood, if I keep doing the stuff I'm supposed to do, and that's still how I do it.
Well, we've got a clip of you playing yourself on The Wire. Let's take a listen.
Now, I know I got one more high left in me. But I doubt very seriously if I have one more recovery. So if there's anybody out there that sees that bottom coming up at them, I'm here to talk sense. I don't care who you are, what you done, or who you done it to. If you're here, so am I.
So, Steve, when you're playing yourself in The Wire, or you're singing these songs that are so personal, are you singing them for people who are like you, like a lot of people are, at least on the inside? They're just trying to get through the day and keep doing the stuff they need to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just doing, look, I'm lucky. I get to make a living doing something I love doing. I was taught to do this. Guy Clark, who was one of my teachers, told me that songs weren't finished before you play them for people. And so I didn't start doing this. I write songs for other people sometimes, specifically, but I write songs mainly to sing myself, and the art's complete when I perform them for an audience. And so the audience is part of that. And
so do you have songs that you have not played for people yet?
I'm not. Like Billy Joel and I have that in common. You know, there's a lot of people. There's the only songs of mine that you haven't heard, you never will hear. They were written. There's a handful. Everything that was sitting around that was worth publishing and worth singing. When I started all over again in 1994, I recorded Ben McCullough and Tom Ames Prayer and Hometown Blues and Sometimes She Forgets, a handful of songs, which dated back as far as 1975, because I didn't get a record deal until 1985. So I emptied the cupboard at that point. Now I write. They're not all on my albums, because I occasionally write stuff for TV shows or for films that I'm specifically asked to write. I'm working on stuff, but sometimes I end up recording myself. I wrote two songs for the Joan Baez record that I produced, and I ended up recording them myself. I've written one song for a Marianne Faithfull record that I'm producing in November already. Marianne and I wrote together. And, you know, so it's just different stuff. I'm writing some music, which is not going to necessarily be songs. There might be a song or two involved in it for a theater piece that I'm going to work on this winter. That begins workshopping this winter with Soho Rep in New York City. So I'm just always looking for something that keeps me interested and keeps me challenged. I'm toying with the idea of a musical, of a Broadway musical.
Wow. Oh, that would be a cool area to go to. Well, let's go to the phones, though. We've got some folks waiting to talk to you. We've got Bob in Claybanks. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hi, Steve. Thanks for keeping on there. And I'm going to see you tonight.
And oh, cool.
I was wondering if you're going to play some of the old stuff.
There'll be some old stuff. I mean, the show's with John Hiatt tonight, so it's only a 75-minute set or so. So I'm probably not going to play everything you want to hear, but there's going to be a lot of stuff off the new record, because I do have a new record out. But you'll hear, you know, you'll hear the stuff that you most want to hear, probably.
Yeah, from what you've been.
You'll hear Guitar Town and Copperhead Road, if that's what you're asking.
Well, that was one, and Good Old Boy was another one I had.
You won't hear that, we haven't played that in a long time, and it's not, you know, it's probably a good idea. We probably should, but this is my 15th studio album, Hoff. It's like a lot of songs. I can't fit them all into one night anymore.
Well, thanks for the call, Bob. Steve Earle, I have a question for you. You said, you know, you'll play the songs that people expect to hear. Have there ever been times in your career where you felt like, I don't want to play, you know, Copperhead Road? Or
No. I don't ever not play Copperhead Road. Occasionally on a solo show, I won't play Guitar Town. I mean, I play it on solo shows, but I don't do it on every single solo show that I do. Any show with the band, I pretty much do. But there's a lot of other songs. I've been around long enough that those are the two biggest songs, and the two songs, if people don't know anything else about me, they know those two songs. And it's two separate audiences. It's weird, because Guitar Town is for my first record, that's an audience that original audience came from country radio, and Copperhead Road is played on rock radio 3.5 years later, but it was almost like another world and another audience. So it's strange. And there are people that think Copperhead Road is my first record. There are people that think that I Feel All Right's my first record. So, or they at least thought so for at some point. So,
well, was that a difficult thing for you when that song took off?
Which one?
Copperhead Road.
No, it wasn't. And in the first place, it didn't take off as much as a lot of people remember it taking off. There's a lot of bad luck involved. I was on a record label that ceased to exist about 2 weeks after the record was released. And it was just a corporate move. They did away with the imprint I was on, which was called Uni Records. It was part of MCA. And it's, you know, I've never whined about that. It was a thing that some people didn't get on rock radio because it was, I've always been, I'm as country as I am, and I rock as hard as I do, and it's kind of always been that way. And so there's some people that need for things to be in a little bit neater, neater little stacks and piles than I do. You should see my apartment. It's not, you know, it's one of those things. my room in the bus right now. But it's not, I'm okay with things being a little untidy.
Now, we were talking politics early on in the interview, and I'm curious, so you've been involved in a lot of causes over the years. Some of them have been more successful than others. You were involved in trying to get John Kerry elected. You've lost some battles. What happens when you lose a few battles with your politics and your music? Do you take it to heart, or do you just keep going?
Well, you learn from it. I mean, it's funny, The Revolution Starts Now as a record. We rushed that record trying to get it out so we could have some sort of effect on that election cycle, and then Kerry didn't get elected, and you know, those of us that were working for the other result thought it was really important that somebody besides George W. Bush not get elected, and John Kerry was the nominee. I'm not a Democrat. I work and vote for Democratic candidates, but I'm not a member of that party, and I'm kind of something well to the left of that. But I'm realistic about what this political system is, and I don't like to waste my vote. So. You know, you just, we're going through what we're going through now. We got a Democratic president of the United States elected, and he's a black man to boot, and it didn't make as much difference, I think, as some people thought it was going to. I'm not as disappointed as some of my friends are. I was listening to him, and I think he's frustratingly moderate for my political taste at times. But I also think I voted for him because I believe that something great and wonderful might happen, and I'm an optimist. The second time I voted for him specifically because he got some semblance of a health care bill passed, and I think people have been trying on my side of things have been trying to do that for 40 years, and he did it, and he deserved my vote the second time around just for that.
All right, well, Steve, we're going to let you get back to your bike ride, but thank you so much, and I hope you have a great time in Wisconsin.
We'll have a good time. We always do, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be Milwaukee, and it's going to be Madison, which is every dog. It's my kind of town. Every dog has a bandana around a stick and a Frisbee in its mouth. I love those places.
All right, we'll look for you. All right, that was Grammy Award-winning musician Steve Earle. His latest album is called The Low Highway.
Coming up, we'll check in with the latest news from Wisconsin with Noah Obshinsky. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our assistant news director, Noah Obshinsky, checks in every week and lets us know what's going on in the week in news in Wisconsin. Noah, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon.
Yeah, well, you know, we talked with State Senator Alberta Darling earlier in the program about her efforts to get tougher drunk driving laws passed. Could you give us a sense of what those new laws look like?
Yeah, you know, as she probably mentioned, there was a public hearing this week. And, you know, the effort to stiffen penalties for drunk driving has ebbed and flowed over the years. Of course, drunk driving is a huge problem. Like in many places, it's a huge problem in Wisconsin. And our laws are relatively loose when you compare them to some other states. And this hearing really marks a renewal of that effort to stiffen these penalties.
But it still seems to run into some opposition, right?
Because penalties mean money.
Money. Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but incarcerating people actually costs money, costs taxpayers a lot of money. And that is actually one of the biggest criticisms that come along with stiffening these penalties. In this case, specifically, two of the bills would establish mandatory minimum prison or jail sentences for people who injure or kill somebody while drinking and driving. Another bill would actually make the third offense a felony. All of this means that if somebody is convicted, they will go to jail. They will spend at least 6 months. And, you know, it costs upwards of $50 or more a day in these county jails to house these prisoners. And that money adds up.
So is money the only issue with this? Or?
Well, I think money is one of the primary issues with this. You know, prosecutors, of course, who are a big stakeholder in all this, in general, they support these measures, but it's not unconditional. You know, they say mandatory minimums can be problematic because obviously they want as much flexibility in the system as they can have. And these mandatory minimums, they say, could be problematic in cases where, you know, the injuries may be minor and the judge will have to sort of adjust the penalty. So, you know, prosecutors support them, but it's definitely conditional.
Well, that's definitely an issue we'll be keeping an eye on then, I guess, in the coming weeks and possibly months. Another issue that we've been talking about on this show, not 45 North, I'm sorry, Central Time, is about the harvest camp that sprung up in Pinoki Hills. More things happened this week, I guess.
Right. Yeah, the Lucuderay Harvest Camp has sort of served as a gathering place for those who are opposed to the proposed iron ore mine up at the Pinokis. In late July, the board up there in Iron County actually voted to pursue criminal and civil charges against the tribe because they felt, the board felt, that the harvest camp, they didn't have the proper permits to be there. And so what happened this week was that the Iron County Board unanimously actually voted, this was on Tuesday, to postpone seeking criminal or civil charges. So, you know, both sides have sort of taken a step back and say, whoa, let's, you know, let's take a step back and let's start to negotiate over this. And in fact, lawyers from both the county and the tribe are going to be coming together in the next 2 weeks to negotiate a way sort of out of this impasse.
And the main bone of contention with that was because of the protesting against the mine?
Or? Yeah, well, and whether or not they had the proper permits to be here. You know, this is a county forest land. So this is public land. And, you know, there are some concerns by folks up there that, you know, this group or these folks who are visiting the harvest camp are essentially squatting, mm-hmm. you know, and that they don't want to take up this space for too long because it's a public place and other people have a right to be there. And of course, there are people who are anti-mine who support the harvest camp and people who are pro-mine who say, you know, they're just protesting. This isn't a harvest camp. This isn't done for ceremonial or spiritual reasons. This is just a protest, you know, no matter what the tribes say. So, you know, I think how you view the harvest camp generally falls into how you view the mining debate.
So what's next then? I guess the negotiation will happen.
Yeah,
we'll go from there.
Yeah, the negotiations are ongoing, and actually, you know, the harvest camp, the future there is unknown. But another tribe, actually, it was announced this week. Another tribe, the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe, say they are actually looking to establish their own camp near the harvest camp, and this one, in this case, would be a spiritual camp run by the tribal elders, and that could be, you know, started here just in the next few days. They're currently negotiating with private landowners and the Nature Conservancy for a location. So we could have two camps up there, actually, pretty soon.
Wow. Okay. Keep an eye on that one then.
Yeah.
Another thing happening in the news, sort of a business story, I guess. So the Skyward Company of Stevens Point has announced some expansion plans.
Big expansion plans, which of course means jobs in Wisconsin. You know, both politicians and business people like talking about jobs. And on the surface, this is, you know, seems like a straight business story, you know. Business in Stevens Point expands. And it is that. But actually, this is a story about one company who lost a bid fairly in a bid process and nearly single-handedly with a few, you know, influential folks on their side, essentially single-handedly got the legislature to change state law so that they alone could stay in business or at the very least stay in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
So, I mean,
what does this company do anyway?
They make software that helps schools track students. And before the state, it was up to districts to decide who they wanted to use to have the software. And Skyward was one company. They had, I think, more than 50% of the market. But what happened was the state said, no, we're going to only have one vendor to supply all this software to all the school districts in the state. And they didn't pick this company. And when they didn't pick this company, the company said, okay, A, we're going to either close, we're going to move out of Wisconsin, and most certainly we're going to start to lobby in order to bring back this multi-vendor system. And that's what they did. And they won.
So what does that say? Business trumps the legislature?
Business, well, yes, jobs. I mean, jobs, I think is part of it. I would also say, and this is a very interesting point too, this is one of the few bipartisan pieces of legislation that actually passed in Madison in this last budget cycle. There are people on both sides who supported this because both political parties saw this as a jobs bill. And according to the company, at least, they say they're ready to grow, from around 400 workers right now to more than 1,000 here in the coming years.
Interesting. We also had a couple big stories outside of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That might be of interest to us in different ways, right?
Yeah. Occasionally you want to look outside the borders and see what's happening. And two stories in particular. One is Illinois Governor Pat Quinn signed a medical marijuana law this week. And that is sort
was that,
of
was that a surprise there?
Well, it's been sitting on his desk. Yeah. It passed the legislature a while ago. It was sitting on his desk and nobody knew what he was going to do. And sort of rather suddenly it said, oh, I'm going to sign it. And he did. He signed it yesterday. And Illinois will join 19 other states and the District of Columbia that have legalized cannabis for patient use.
So the impact here is peer pressure?
Well, it's a border state. Yeah. I mean, it's a border state. There could be just more marijuana out there in the world, in a border state.
Right.
So some of it may end up in Wisconsin. Who knows? There may be law enforcement implications to this. If somebody from Illinois is pulled over in Wisconsin, what does that mean if they have marijuana in their car? I mean, I think it raises a lot of interesting issues. And, there's a momentum to this kind of thing, to these social issues. Now, with this legislature and with this governor, I don't see Wisconsin passing a medical marijuana law anytime soon. But there is a momentum to these things. And Illinois is just another in a long line of states who have decided to legalize medical marijuana.
All right. And then also Minnesota has had a law change.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, this week.
Not related to marijuana.
Not related to marijuana. But this week, same-sex couples in Minnesota could start getting married. The law was passed a while ago, but they could start getting married this week. And married they did. And that included couples from Wisconsin who we don't have gay marriage here in Wisconsin. And so couples actually went to Minnesota and got married.
And do you really think people could move across the border too? I think that was something that was discussed yesterday on the program.
Yeah, I think I think we can't say for sure how many people are going to move, but I think that is a concern, and I think it will certainly play in people's own decision making. If a same-sex couple in Wisconsin, say they live in a border community in Wisconsin, I'm sure they would probably give them some pause and say, maybe it makes better sense to move across the Mississippi River where my marriage will be recognized by the state government.
But could it also have the impact of making Wisconsin think about this?
Again, with this legislature and with this governor, I don't see gay marriage really, or at least passing of it on the agenda. I really don't, at least not in the short term. Of course, anything is possible. But of course, this has implications again for couples who might want to move to Minnesota, or for same-sex couples who are opting to go and get married in Minnesota and spend those dollars, because of course, weddings mean money.
Yeah.
And, there are communities, including Minneapolis and others in Minnesota, who are enjoying the benefits of people from Wisconsin going to Minnesota to get married.
Well, it's always good to hear your wrap up of the week. Thanks for checking in, Noah.
Thanks. Yeah, no problem.
That's WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. And coming up, we'll take a look at the biggest roller derby gathering in the country. It's called Roller Cons, happening in Las Vegas. And also take a look at the tradition of yodeling in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, and I promise we will not yodel ourselves. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.